Hi, I'm Armin Alney, host of To The Point in Which Way LA, and thanks so much for listening to our programs. If you're like me and you need help navigating the busy film awards season, I've got a podcast for you to check out. It's called The Treatment, hosted by Elvis Mitchell. He goes beyond the plot to understand what inspires the actors, the filmmakers, the producers, and others to do what they do. You can find The Treatment on KCRW's iTunes page. Hello again, I'm Warren Alney. A Federal Committee on Dietary Guidelines reports that 65% of American women are overweight or obese, along with 70% of men. Its findings on how we got that way and what should be done have surprised most nutritional experts and outraged parts of the food industry. We'll talk about that later on To The Point. First, this story. The former Los Angeles mayor, Antonio Villaraigosa, announced today he will not enter the race for Barbara Boxer's seat in the U.S. Senate. He said, "I am humbled by the encouragement I've received from so many to serve in the United States Senate, but as I think about how best to serve the people of this great state, I know that my heart and my family are here in California, not in Washington, D.C. Ruben Navarrete is Southern California-based CNN contributor. He's a nationally syndicated columnist with the Washington Post Writers Group. Ruben, good to have you back on our program.
Great to be with you again. Thanks.
Are you surprised? A lot of his friends thought he was going to run.
I am surprised. I got to say, I think that a lot of folks did think he was making those kinds of movements. He was out raising money. He had hired a firm, which I think he's going to keep on retainer up in Sacramento, Mercury Public Affairs, to handle a possible run. And I think this was a surprise to many folks. It was probably the money. You're going to hear that over and over again, the money that scared him off. $100 to $120 million this race will cost in the long run. And I don't think he thought he could raise that much money, and that was probably a big factor.
Do you think that a lot of Democrats effectively passed him over in favor of Attorney General Kamala Harris?
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. It's been written up to death in Politico. I wrote a column in the Daily Beast about it as well. It's been clear for about 2 months now, or ever since Kamala Harris made it clear that this was hers for the asking, the seat, that they almost closed the door and said, no more nominations, no more applications. We're done now. And many Latinos started to grumble about that, and rightfully so, because as I said previously to someone this morning, Latinos don't like the Republican Party. They hate the Republican Party, and we often feel the feeling is mutual. We don't go around thinking Republicans owe us anything, but Democrats owe us a lot, because for 50 years, Latinos have voted time and again for Democratic candidates at every level. And Latinos did feel slighted and continue to feel slighted about this, regardless of what Villaraigosa decided. We're back to square one.
Do you think that there ought to be a Latino candidate? If it's not Villaraigosa, should somebody else run?
Absolutely. And I think you're talking the next set of names you're going to be hearing are everybody from Alex Padilla, the Secretary of State, Hilda Solis, the newly minted L.A. County supervisor. You're going to hear Javier Becerra, the congressman, mentioned. And there are going to be many folks who think a Latino should be in a race where you have a state that's 40% Latino. One in five voters on Election Day are Latino. I think it's imperative that Latinos make a showing in this race. Villaraigosa was considered probably the pick of the litter because while he doesn't get a lot of respect in Southern California, he has an incredible national network. He knows as a community organizer how to organize folks like our current president does. And he has great labor support. So he was going to be a player. There's no doubt he was going to be a factor.
Ruben Navarrete with CNN and the Washington Post Writers Group. Arturo Vargas is executive director of the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials, NALEO. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Sure, Warren. Good afternoon.
What's your take on this? Were you surprised, too?
Not necessarily. Knowing the mayor, I know he's had an interest really in the governorship of California, and I think he also sees himself more as an executive than part of a legislative body. And whether he was going to raise $100 million for this race or $100 million 2 years from now or 4 years from now for the governor's race, I think is incidental to the fact that he was looking for the best suit for him. Having said that, I still think that there are plenty of qualified Latinos who are out there in the wings who are really looking at this as a real possibility for themselves.
As to legislative experience, though, he was Speaker of the State Assembly. That's the second most powerful job in the state.
He was Speaker of the Assembly, but it's pretty tough to compare that to being the mayor of the second largest city in the country, where you're running a city that's virtually your own little state.
Okay, we've heard Alex Padilla, we've heard Hilda Solis. Who do you think are the likely candidates?
Well, those are two members of Congress, I think, who are taking a hard look at this, include Javier Becerra and Loretta Sanchez from Orange County. Both of them have demonstrated, you know, their fortitude in the Congress. I think this race is wide open. I do not believe that this is a coronation for the Attorney General. As capable as she has been, she surely has some advantage, having run statewide, but so does now Secretary Padilla. I think it's going to be an interesting development as we go forward.
On the other hand, as Ruben Navarrete pointed out, we're talking about $120 million. That's a lot of money for anybody. Do those people have that amount? Or I don't know the answer to this. Does the Senate have the top two rule like the legislature does, so that people from both from one party can get into the runoff?
Those are the rules that California voters have set for themselves for all of their congressional races, as well as state legislative races and state executive offices, for better or for worse. And I think this is something that California needs to take a hard look at, if this is getting the results that the proponents of this system had indicated we would see, more moderate Democrats or moderate Republicans. I'm not so sure that's exactly the case. I think what it's done is really ace out third-party candidates and given a much more of advantage to well-funded candidates who can get into the top two.
But for a Senate race, you'd have to win the party primary, wouldn't you, and then stand off against a Republican?
Not in California.
Even for the U.S. Senate?
Even for the U.S. Senate, just like you don't do that for Congress.
So you could then be a distant second and still make it into the runoff.
That's correct. We could have two Democrats in the runoff, or two Republicans in the runoff, or one of each.
Okay, so Ruben Navarrete, back to you. Does that rule make it more likely that somebody else might want to get into this race?
I think it's a factor for sure, but I think I always come back to the money. If you're one of these names we've mentioned or some others we haven't thought about, you're thinking about how expensive it's going to be and how you're going to spend every waking hour between now and Election Day raising money and whether you can pull it off. It's an exhausting and humbling experience if you come up short and aren't able to raise the money. So that'll be a factor. I think the question for Latinos and all this, they're going to be asking what Antonio Villaraigosa got from the people have already asked this. What did he get in return for stepping aside? Because he was a formidable threat. And at the end of the day, Antonio is going to be fine. For better or for worse, he, you know, as I said, Antonio Villaraigosa is a lawyer who has one client. That's Antonio Villaraigosa, to my mind. And he's always looking out for himself, and he did again here. You're going to hear grumblings from Latinos that he sold them out, that he disappointed them, that, you know, whatever, he let them down. But at the end of the day, we're back to where we started. No representation in this race. Antonio got something good for stepping aside. We'll come to find out what that is. But to Arturo's point, let's not forget, when he's ready to run for governor, Antonio is, he's going to run into another problem. That's another Willie Brown protege in the offing, and that's Gavin Newsom, our lieutenant governor, who plans to run for governor. So Antonio Villaraigosa was steamrolled by the Willie Brown Democratic political machine this time around. It'll happen again in 4 years.
Arturo Vargas, what do you say to that?
Well, hey, this is politics at its best and its worst. And as far as raising the money, that just is the reality of running statewide in California. So part of what Latino candidates need to do to show that they are competitive is to be able to raise that money. And as we get more and more Latinos and Latinas who are in a position to run for statewide office, they're going to learn how to raise the kind of money needed to run statewide in the state.
As to what he might have gotten for stepping aside, nobody ever does anything for nothing. Hillary Clinton has been in the state very recently. Do you think there's any possibility, Arturo Vargas, that there was some thought about a national appointment of some kind?
You mean should Hillary Clinton become president of the
sure.
United States? Well, I think that is a little too far off in the future to make any, that's not a bet I would take. It's somewhere to offer me that too many uncertainties.
Okay, point well taken. Thank you both for being with us. Arturo Vargas, again, with the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials, executive director of that organization. Ruben Navarrete with CNN and the Washington Post Writers Group. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Back in a moment with Which Way LA.
Subscribe to the Which Way LA podcast at kcrw.com or download the KCRW app, available anywhere podcasts are found and on all mobile devices.
Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. John Dacey has resigned as superintendent of LA Unified, and interim successor Ramon Cartina says the district cannot afford to continue Dacey's now discredited program of iPads for everybody. It's now the subject of a federal criminal investigation. But here's a headline from an editorial in today's LA Times. LAUSD should try again on supplying computers. We'll start our program there with editorial writer Karen Klein. Karen, welcome to our program.
Hiya, thanks for inviting me.
So what needs to be done, and do you have to make a case for digital education at this point?
I don't think anybody should have to make a case for digital education. I think at this point, given what careers are demanding of students, not having a digital education be at least part of a student's basic schooling would be a tremendous lack in that education. It would be putting out students who are not as prepared as their more affluent peers to go out into succeeding colleges, to succeed in even pretty basic jobs that want familiarity with the office suites and so forth that computers require, that all offices are using. So I don't think doing without some kind of digital education is even an option for LAUSD. I think it just needs to do it a lot smarter than it did it the first time.
Were you surprised that Ramon Cartina's canceled the program?
No, I wasn't at all surprised. And I think it's important to note that he didn't cancel the idea of digital education. He only canceled the idea of one device for each student, which was what Dacey had proposed. It was an $800 device about, and it would have gone into the hands of every single student, including kindergartners. Incredibly expensive, $500 million. I'm not sure that all of those were necessary. I'm not sure that all of them were even desirable. I'm not sure that we want kindergartners and first graders to be focusing that heavily on digital devices. But that doesn't mean that students don't need a lot more access to digital devices than they already have. They need to be able to work with educational software. They need to be able to do research on computers. They need to be able to write on computers. And they, of course, need to take the new standardized tests on computers. It's not really an option to not have computers for students.
So how did things go as badly as they did, or why did they, and how could the district be smarter?
Well, I'm not really sure where Dr. Dacey got the idea that he was going to do a device for every student. I know that he had
Every student, every administrator, and every teacher.
That's right. That's right. About 700,000 or more devices at close to $800 each. I think some of it might have had to do with his own dedication to the idea that the impoverished students of LA Unified should have the things that their more privileged peers have. So I think he went for the best kind of device, the brand name device, the iPad, the thing everybody has their eyes on and wants, that his students weren't going to have to settle for getting second-rate stuff or less expensive stuff, that it wouldn't be about, gee, let's be very cost-effective, let's get the really big thing. And I think he also kind of liked the splash that got this huge school district buying all these devices. But I think he really felt that these are students who don't have high-level things in their life a whole lot, and they should have the very best devices. The thing is that you're still a public agency. You still need to be cost-effective. You need to look at the best digital device and the right number of digital devices for the price, for what taxpayers have to pay, especially considering that these things last, what, 3 or 4 years?
Karen Klein again, education editorial writer for the LA Times. Let me introduce Bernadette Lucas. She is director of the Instructional Technology Initiative for LA Unified, and she is a former elementary school principal. Ms. Lucas, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Do you think Karen Klein has it right? Was it Mr. Dacey's insistence that the poorest kids get the best possible equipment? Did he want to make a splash? Did the brand name Apple have a lot to do with it?
I would submit the answer is no. I certainly do not want to speak for Dr. Dacey, but I do want to speak for the intention of the project. I think, as most people know, the devices weren't chosen by a single person. The devices resulted from an RFP process that was part of a much bigger process in our district. So that choice did not result from one person. The notion of a splash, I think, takes away from the importance of educational technology for all students and how not just one person was dedicated to that for our kids. I've spoken to many principals and teachers who see an urgency around this for all students, be them more socioeconomically challenged or more fluent. I think sometimes there's a misunderstanding that kids who have more access in their homes use those devices for educational purposes. So our intention is that every single student in this district, regardless of socioeconomic status, race, ethnicity, where they live in the city, has access to educational technology, not just technology.
There was a poll done by a member of the Board of Education and some employee unions, surveys of teachers and administrators, and they discovered there were anonymous responses. 36% of teachers favored the iPad effort. 90% of administrators felt the same way. Were teachers not brought on board?
I don't know that teachers weren't brought on board. I think we can always look at how we can include more stakeholders and hear their voice more. So, of course, when we hear a number like that, as district employees, I was a teacher at one point. I want to reach out to teachers and hear their perspective. As you mentioned, Mr. Only, I was an elementary school principal. This type of initiative, really any educational initiative, will not work without teacher leadership. Their voice is essential. The task force that Mr. Cortinas is having us convene will speak directly to these types of issues. I think it's very important to learn from the past, have lessons learned, but for the sake of our kids right now, I think we need to look to the future with those lessons learned in context.
So the program hasn't completely gone away. There are iPads in the district. They are in use. Which schools have them? How many teachers are actually using them?
So we have 101 schools under the initiative right now with a vision for every school looking at how they use educational technology. So we have a 47 plus 11 schools that have the technology in their schools right now. And, of course, each school is different, and teachers are attending professional development and learning. Principals are doing the same. So each school would be there would be a different answer for each school. I think what's important to note is that schools are provided with professional development. And when I say schools, I mean teachers, principals, and parents are fully included in this process, and then we look to our students as leaders in this work. So I would have to answer for each school to really speak to your question well.
What about the concern that Karen Klein expressed earlier that iPads were going to be distributed to kids in kindergarten and first grade? Mm-hmm. Is that necessary?
When you look at the Common Core standards, it's impossible to master the Common Core standards without educational technology. The ratio of the technology is something that we can all debate and talk about. Again, I was an elementary school principal, and I've worked with my colleagues for years now, and there is absolutely a place, in my humble opinion, for educational technology in kindergarten and first grade. I saw firsthand what well-executed use of educational technology can do for kids. The technology, here's the myth that I think is out there that it's incumbent upon us as administrators and educators to share. It's not the technology in and of itself that's going to make the difference. It's how teachers leverage the technology. So to say, and I mean no disrespect by this, I'm trying to make an analogy. To say that there's no place for educational technology, or are we sure that kindergarten and first graders need it, to me is on the same level as asking, do kindergartners and first graders need textbooks or educational resources of other sorts?
Bernadette Lucas again, Director of the Instructional Technology Initiative at LA Unified, and as she indicated, a former teacher and a former principal as well. Leslie Wilson is with us, CEO of the One-to-One Institute. That's a nonprofit based in Michigan that consults with school districts on digital device programs. It did not work with the LAUSD. Leslie Wilson, good to have you on our program.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
What does one-to-one mean?
One-to-one means that every child has his or her personal portable technology that allows them to personalize their learning experiences so that they can master their greatest potential.
Does that mean kindergarten and first graders too?
Absolutely. I totally agree with the former panelist from LA Unified. There is no question about the fact that every child, anywhere and anytime, preschool, does benefit greatly from having access and effective utilization of technology, which is not to say that that displaces other human contact, interaction, peer collaboration, et cetera, but it is a part of the fabric of our lives, as your first panelist described. And as such, it is just the normal part of the ecosystem of all of our children, no matter what age.
What about the situation here in Los Angeles now? How do you assess it? Here we have a superintendent who has resigned over this. There's an investigation underway having to do with his associations with Apple and with Pearson, the educational software provider. And the program is regarded at the moment as a bit of a debacle. Could it have been done better?
Absolutely. There is no question that it could have been done better. There is no reasonable reason why it happened this way, in my professional opinion. And I say that with the authority and expertise of having done a lot of research on this through Project Red, through Freedom to Learn, through the Maine State Initiative One-to-One, and through a lot of the work we did in Michigan and Michigan's One-to-One program. Many best practices emerged from all of that research that clearly dictated the essential factors for implementing robust education technology one-to-one programs, particularly at the scale that LA Unified sought to do. There is no question that the research was out there. The network of professionals across our country who have done this was out there that could have been of utmost support and help. I think Dr. Dacey's mission and vision, whoever said this earlier, was totally on point. He believed in the social justice and equality for all of his kids. Very admirable. What followed that missed the step. I never worked with LA Unified. I have not talked with anybody in LA Unified. I had one conference call with a group through the virtue of a vendor and as it began, but I don't know the details of that. But I think it's very clear, number one, the question in my mind would be, why iPad? And I think the first person who spoke talked about, you know, the sexy, glimmering, glamorous device, and Apple has a great salespeople who sell you and pitch you and develop relationships with you. And quite honestly, the iPad has been an undoing for many districts who sought to go one-to-one. It's a great device. It has its place. But the focus needs to be on what is the functionality of the device that's meaningful for the learner at which level. So the first thing, the most paramount piece of the equation is the child, is the learner. What is it we want this child to be able to do through learning activities to reach his or her full potential? When we back that up and we look at all the plethora of devices available today and all the different price points, there are so many options out there. It needs to be very cogently focused on what are we going to choose and why. Price is obviously budget is a huge part of this, but also is the functionality. And to say that every child in any district should have an iPad is ludicrous, is absolutely ludicrous. The iPad does not do for let's say any tablet, excuse me for, you know, honing in on the iPad, but adolescents, you know, middle school and high school kids will tell you if you ask them, what is your go-to device? And they will tell you it is a robust kind of a laptop kind of thing because it does everything. They multitask, they multimedia, they're researching while they're IMing and chatting, et cetera, et cetera. So it's crucial to choose a device according to what the functionality is you seek.
Okay, let me just quickly go back to Bernadette Lucas with the LA Unified School District. Is there an effort now to diversify and to provide different kinds of devices for different levels of education?
Absolutely. I think if one were to look at the recent developments in our district, we have a laptop pilot at our high school level. That was resolved by brought to resolution action by one of our board members. Our superintendent Cortinas has talked in many different settings about school choice, so that schools may back map from the needs of the students at their school to the device that's needed. I, as a former principal, did the same thing. So we are in complete agreement with the points that were just made.
Let me introduce Naomi Barron. She is author of a book called Words on Screen. She's professor of linguistics at American University and directs the Center for Teaching, Research, and Learning World Languages and Cultures. Good to have you on our program.
It's wonderful to be here.
Let me ask you, do you think that technology at the kindergarten and first grade levels is as important as our other guests have said?
what I like about what both Bernadette Lucas said and Leslie Wilson said was the functionalities are what has to determine the forms. So there's some things that for very young kids, let's call it lower school, particularly the lower grades of lower school, kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade maybe, there's some things you can do that are very useful with the technology, such as an iPad or with a mobile phone or with a computer for that matter. My concern is that we now have a growing amount of research that says there are things you probably don't want to have young kids doing on those devices because doing it by hand or doing it on a printed version is much more useful. So there are a lot of data suggesting that, if, for example, if you're learning to write, that you do it by hand, and I don't care if we're talking about cursive or print at this point. It does different things to your brain. It does different things to your memory ability. Your brain functions differentially if you are using your hands interactively rather than punching keys on a keypad or a keyboard. So my concern here is that if we have a device we spent a lot of money on, like most consumers, whether we're the school administrators or the teachers or the parents who are paying the taxes to generate the revenues to pay for these devices, we want to get a return on investment. Therefore, the notion of, here I'm quoting Bernadette Lucas, what matters is how teachers leverage the technology, or what Leslie Wilson said, is the functionality of the device for the learner. Those are the questions we have to ask, and my concern is we're going to be too obsessed with using the device in places they probably are not educationally best suited.
You've done a lot of research into this. Can you learn to love reading from a screen?
You can. Here's the challenge that I see. When I ask university-age students, which is the cohort that I've done most of my research on, but you read lots of what's written from middle schoolers, surveys of middle schoolers, similarly high school, you'll be amazed to see that these people who live by their digital devices understand that if you want to do something in a concentrated, focused, removed, in the best sense of the term, way, doing it in print makes it easier to do that. If you have, say, the original Kindle or Kindle Paperwhite, where the only thing you can do is download books, essentially, give or take, then you don't have those distractions just waiting to tempt you. But the reason that tablets took off and started surpassing sales of e-readers is because tablets are multifunctional. And then we have these things called e-readers that are Kindle Fire, and they're sort of tablets. If you survey students, they will tell you the place where they can concentrate best if they're reading, whether they're reading for schoolwork or whether they're reading for pleasure, is in print.
Okay, let me go back to Bernadette Lucas at LA Unified. Does the program that you are working on now have the kinds of options that Naomi Barron is talking about?
Absolutely. I think the points Professor Barron made are right on target. Those are the kind of conversations that we have at an initiative level and that we have with principals and that teachers and principals, parents are having at school sites. So I think it's very important for all of us to recognize that educational decisions are made during this process. Teachers are still teachers. The technology does not replace them. The technology does not outrank them. Teachers are still making professional decisions that they've always made. What they need is research, dialogue, conversation, feedback from principals and from other teachers around how we're executing educational technology. I agree with every point Professor Barron made and saw that play out at my own school site.
Well, let me go back to Professor Barron. Do you think that the LA Unified School District moved too fast initially?
I wasn't there to watch, the blow-by-blow. The sentiment of having a device that a student can identify with as mine is not ill-placed. It may not be financially feasible, but I'll give an analogy. In a number of parts of Africa where there's a very low reading, where there's a very low literacy rate, there are organizations such as World Reader that are supplying really inexpensive mobile phones that have available for free, because it's being paid for by World Reader, free to the user, whatever book you want to read. And that's a way to seed a real amount of reading and learning. We give individual textbooks to students. And why do we do that? Because that's something they can identify with. They may have to give it back at the end of the term, but it's still something they identify with. If it is not financially feasible to give every every child, especially in the younger grades, their own devices, you figure out how to share. You know, we used to share who took the bunny home over the weekend. You can share things and still have the benefits of learning how to use the technologies when you're together or when it's your turn to take it home.
Okay. I want to go back to Karen Klein, the educational editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times, for a couple of questions. We don't have a lot of time, but I know you're a parent, and I'm first interested in your reaction to the idea that children who are kindergartners and first graders can, in fact, be served well by having technological devices.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not saying that exposure to digital devices is a bad thing for kindergartners and first graders, but I do not think that they need a one-to-one program, or that they should be, because a one-to-one program and taking it home means a lot of time spent with a device.
Okay, then comes the question of can the LAUSD find the money to do this again? We don't want to get into the issue of having used bond money, which is supposed to be used for long-term purposes, and yet I believe you were the one who pointed out that the iPads don't last very long. This is also a subject for election time, with three members of the board now up for election. Do you see a smooth road ahead?
A smooth road ahead? It depends. I mean, I don't know how the election is going to affect the ability of a couple of the board members, especially Tamar Galatzin, who is a big, big supporter of the iPad program. I don't know if that's going to affect her ability to be reelected. She certainly deserves criticism for how she handled that vote. On the other hand, the Los Angeles Times endorsed her for re-election, because I don't think the iPad is the be-all and end-all of what goes on the school board. There are many, many issues that have to be taken into account. I think in this case, we had a very excited superintendent who was a leader, and he was being followed by his board, and the board were not asking the questions that should have been asked. We wrote several editorials saying the questions aren't being answered, and it just seemed to be this ship that was going off on its own, and there was no way to stop it. I think now, I'm not saying that it's a good thing that Dr. Dacey is gone, but I do think that sort of, you know, where people are being challenged, that if you oppose anything about the iPad program, he said you were, you know, this was a civil rights issue and you were against civil rights for poor and minority students, if you opposed his particular initiative, that kind of thinking is gone more, and I think the district is well posed to go on a more thoughtful track than it has been, and I think Bernadette pointed out that it is on a much more thoughtful track. So I think things will go much more smoothly no matter how the election works out.
Well, thank you all very much. Karen Klein, again, education editorial writer for the LA Times, Bernadette Lucas at LA Unified, Leslie Wilson with the One-to-One Institute, Naomi Baron, author of Words on Screen, and a professor at American University. Great to have you all. Thank you so much for being part of this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
And remember, you can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, America's diet and the environment on To the Point.